We're privileged to have on campus for this convocation the presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, H. George Anderson. Certain events occurring at the ELCA National Assembly this past summer reinforced the conviction of most of us that Bishop Anderson's church body and our own are on increasingly diverging paths in a number of important theological and ecumenical issues. That fact is not to be celebrated, but to be deplored. And at the same time, the very fact that we are moving in different directions, our two churches, mandates, it would seem to us on this campus, the need to seize every opportunity to discuss what has propelled us down those paths, to clarify issues, to dissolve unfair stereotypes, and to identify as well our significant common interests as Lutheran Christians who share an identical Reformation and confessional heritage and in large measure speak the same language to the world, a point that I think Bishop Anderson will be making in his comments, especially on Lutheranism and society. There can be no more capable an ELCA leader to participate in such discussions than its own presiding bishop, George Anderson. He is forthright in his views, he is articulate, and he is theologically astute. He is also quite at home in the halls of theological seminaries. Bishop Anderson is a graduate of Yale University. He received his seminary and STM degrees from Lutheran Theological Seminary at Philadelphia. He holds the MA and PhD degrees from the University of Pennsylvania. He began his career as a seminary professor. He served as professor of church history at Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina from 1958 to 1970. And he was president of that seminary from 1970 to 1981. Following his presidency at Lutheran Southern Seminary, he was elected president of Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and served in that position for 13 years. He was elected presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in 1995. He is editor, translator, and author of numerous scholarly books and essays which have contributed to a greater understanding of American Lutheranism and its history in particular. We welcome to our convocation this morning and to our campus the presiding bishop of the ELCA, Dr. H. George Anderson.
Thank you, President Johnson, and thank you also for the invitation from the faculty to have this opportunity to talk with you this morning. I appreciate your taking the time to be here. The way I plan to operate is to spend some time laying out some of my own perspective on our Lutheran situation in this country, and then try to open up enough time so that we can have extended opportunity for interaction and questions. I agree with the assumption that our church bodies are moving in diverging directions. And it's this great spiritual problem to me that this is taking place. I come from a time in the history of the Lutheran Church in this country when such divergence was not the case, but that there was a general feeling that we were moving closer together. And out of that fundamental and foundational experience that I had in my formative years in seminary and early in teaching, it has always been my hope that we could find our way at least to parallel paths in my lifetime so that the breaches between us do not increase. And I know that from your side, it may seem that the ELCA is going off and doing all kinds of crazy and irresponsible things. And I would say to you in beginning that our understanding of our own task as a church with an ecumenical vision is that the first step in working with other traditions is self-criticism. That is, we recognize that repentance is a part of any relationship with other Christians, and that, of course, also is true in terms of our relationships with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Rather than dwell on sins, however, at the beginning, I would like to try to interpret for you the kind of thinking that is now going on in some branches of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I say that because, as is the case with LCMS, we are a varied church. We have groups that espouse various positions in various directions. But I want to tell you now how a process that we've gone through in the last 3 years has led us to understand our society and our understanding of the mission of the ELCA in that society. And I might say, when I say mission of the ELCA, I could just as well say a mission for all Lutherans, as I hope will become clear. Demographers tell us that Americans are a nation on the move. In any five-year period during the last 20 years, 40%, 4 out of every 10 Americans move their place of residence. And that's only a symbol for a kind of spiritual rootlessness that goes along with and is in some measure produced by that geographical shifting. We sense in our society a lack of connectedness. There is no sense of a wider American community anymore. The old landmarks of authority, the old standards, canons of literature or of the history of our country are all questioned. They've either been discarded or discredited. And many feel now that in our society there is no center, no stable reference point for persons or for societies or institutions anymore. And that has led to a general sense of distractedness in society. I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker not long ago. A man was sitting in the doctor's office. There was a large window behind him. And he said, excuse me, doc, my attention wandered for a minute. What kind of a deficit disorder did you say I had? If we are indeed living in a society where when people come to worship, they are still far too immersed in the issues and the uncertainties and ambiguities of their situation, that they are literally distracted, and we have to think about how our worship can help these people center and then hear. But in each case, what I'm going to say, there is a double side. I've said a little bit about the critical problem before us. I now want to say that this is also an opportunity for the church. In this time when society is indeed in a molten state, that is when everything is being reinvented, the church has a matchless opportunity to be engaged in shaping whatever new shape society will take, because believe me, there will be a new concretion, there will be a new shape of this society. Not soon, but later. I'm giving it a generation or perhaps more. The question is, can the church be engaged in this reshaping? Because in my view, historically, it is the communities that have a clear purpose and definite goals that become the crystallization points for whatever the world of the future is going to look like. So instead of seeing it as a sense of loss, one might see it as a sense of opportunity now to be a key player in whatever shape society will take. A second issue which became very clear to us in our study is that our people are living under increased stress. I can remember, because I was in the college and seminary work for so many years, that 20 years ago, people were predicting that the big problem of the 90s was going to be leisure. People were going to have so much leisure time that they were not going to know what to do with it. Things have turned out quite the opposite. Families feel that two incomes are no longer adequate to maintain their needed living standards. Downsizing, right-sizing, reductions in force, and other such euphemisms for losses of jobs raise uncertainty in the minds of people who are employed in a way that in the past, when persons signed up with large corporations, they never thought they'd have to think about again. And so these people live under monumental pressure, and some of you have been in companies and in positions where you know that very well. But it's not only the breadwinners in families, it's not only the parents. Children and young people face far greater requirements on their time from their school and even from their extracurricular activities. Life is experienced as a series of demands exceeding the resources of time or energy or sometimes even talent available. Leisure itself has become work. People are bombarded with statements like, there's no free lunch. What goes around comes around. You get what you pay for. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. Maybe Luther in his day worried about a gracious God. I think people today perceive society as their judge, and they feel that they have come up lacking. We live, in fact, in a demand society. People live under the law. It is not necessarily the law of God, but they feel that somehow they are being judged day by day. Now, on the other side, this situation, it seems to me, calls for a word of grace. We are a church of grace and gratitude. What better word do we have to give to this society than that, in fact, at the heart of reality, there is a God who loves us, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. What a dramatic and freeing word of understanding about the nature of reality, contrary to the appearances that one finds in human society. In other words, we have a word of release, a word that can help people simplify their lives and focus on the one thing needful. Thirdly, we feel that as we look at our society and the inquiries that we have done among our church people, we feel that people are seeking a voice. They feel marginalized. People feel themselves pushed farther and farther out to the margins of society. They believe that decisions about their lives are being made by others who don't consult them, or in fact don't even care about what they think or their welfare. The social conventions that formerly protected the church, Sunday closing, for example, or the assumption that church membership was a mark of good citizenship, these have dissolved. They're no longer there. Congregations in rural areas and in urban settings often discover that they are the only institution left in their neighborhood or in their community. The banks have gone, the schools have gone, professional people have gone. The church is the only thing left. Now, that can all be seen as a tragedy for us, that we have lost our place in American society. It can also be seen as a tremendous gift to us by God. Because this position, this marginalization of the church, allows us the possibility of identifying with the poor and the dispossessed in a way that our former position of privilege never really let us do. It was charity. It was not necessary solidarity. The church need not be afraid of being pushed to the edge of society. I think the lusting for those days is perhaps misplaced. After all, the church was born on the fringes of society. The church is, one could say, genetically engineered to live in a hostile environment. Our DNA is essentially engineered to thrive in diversity, in what the Bible calls tribulation. The word tribulation is an image from millstones, grinding. And for a society that feels itself often in that way, the church says, we understand this situation. This is what our Lord told us life was going to be like. So I should say we could call it the church's DNA. We could also call it the church's BNA. We could simply say, be not afraid. That's what the Lord said to the church in the early days, to the disciples, and perhaps it is the word that will call us back to the power of the gospel rather than the power of our social position or the prestige of our pulpits. Fourthly, society seems today to be pulled apart, not pushed together by this tribulation, by these pressures. Social pressures have not led to common action, but to separation and polarization. Rodney King's famous plea after his beating, "Why can't we all get along?" still echoes unanswered. Litigation is now an everyday word, and violence has become an everyday experience, an everyday fare on the news. The United States has one of the greatest gaps between rich and poor of any nation in the world. Polarization between rich and poor, young and old, intention over dwindling resources, black and white, all the traditional rifts seem to be exacerbated under the pressures of society today. Individuals and groups feel isolated, but their solution is not to reach out, but rather to pull up the drawbridge and further cut themselves off. Every day when I turn my car into the main road, I see a sign on the property just opposite the place where I turn, posted on a tree. It says, "Forget the dog, beware of owner." Just to be sure you get the message, the owner has now added a new sign underneath, "No trespassing." Now, in this tense situation, it seems to me that the church is called to demonstrate the possibility of a community where members are indeed reconciled to one another across all the fault lines of society. In our fractured world, it would indeed be a sign of hope if people could see in the church the kind of reconciliation that Paul pointed to and spoke so fondly of when he spoke to persons in his own day. And you remember the book of Ephesians puts it so clearly that the powers are to be shown by the existence of the church, where Jew and Gentile have been brought together under Christ. The powers are to be shown by this fact that the plan of God is being carried out in the world. So we have an evangelical and evangelistic duty to be the kind of community that people will say Christians indeed love one another. What does that have to say to us as Lutherans in this generation? And the final point I want to make in terms of issues facing us is widespread spiritual hunger. People look back on the 50s as the age of religious revival in this country. I believe that we are in the midst of another major spiritual revival in the United States. The problem is, though, people are not coming to us. They are not coming to the institutional church anymore. They are now looking to New Age religions, Zen Buddhism, adaptations of Native American religion, astrology, and a host of other movements. This year, those sources of, quote, spirituality will account for about $500 million worth of business in bookstores, selling crystals, books, and other paraphernalia. Our ELCA website tracks the number of visits it receives from people both within the United States and out. I was shocked to discover that a survey of a six-week period last fall indicated that the largest number of out of the United States hits, the largest number of visits to our website from out of the United States did not come from Canada, didn't come from Germany, not from Scandinavia. It came from Japan. There is a whole world looking out there, and they are looking at our door, at our website, without us even being aware. Do we realize that we literally must speak to the world about our faith? The positive side of the spiritual hunger, of course, is that people are dissatisfied with the state of their own souls. Again, I saw a cartoon not long ago. It was a posh New York apartment. People were lounging about in a kind of languid way, and one of them was saying to the others, "You know, last week, I think I had a near-life experience." That tells me something about the self-diagnosis of our own intellectual elite. Where is it that they can find good spiritual food, meat? Where can they find the kind of strength from the Word that is a sure word and not simply a fabrication of their own imaginations? Indeed, they are looking. They may not be coming to us to ask, "Is there any word from the Lord?" But they are indeed running up and down looking for a word from the Lord. And the question is, are we ready to speak to them in words they can understand? Now, I make a point of that because we have a theological vocabulary that is precious to us and a theological treasure. But the issue is, can we understand their needs and speak to their needs in a language that will make sense to them? I have heard the tale told of a man from Minnesota who was supposed to go to Spain for his firm, for his business. And he was panicked because he didn't know Spanish. So he went to a friend of his and said, what's the best way to learn Spanish? Do I take tapes, or do I get some kind of video, or should I get private tutoring? And the friend said, "Spanish, that's easy. All you have to do is talk slow and loud." So the guy got to Spain, got off the plane, took a cab to the hotel, walked up to the hotel and said, "Hello, I am from Minnesota, and I would like a room." The hotel clerk said, "Well, I am from Minnesota, too. What kind of room would you like?" This went on then for about 5 minutes back and forth. Finally, the first guy said, "Wait a minute. If you are from Minnesota, and I am from Minnesota, why are we talking Spanish?" There's a lesson in there for us. And now, with that caveat, I want to mention very briefly four gifts I think that the Lutheran Church has to give to the society that I've just talked about, this spiritually hungry society. First, it has the doctrine of being saint and sinner at the same time. Simul justus et peccator. I think that'd make a great bumper sticker, wouldn't it? Simul justus et peccator. It would catch people's attention right away. We know in the Lutheran Church that sin, like Wile E. Coyote, never seems to die. It always comes back for another assault. And that is indeed an important word to a society that believes there are quick and easy solutions to every problem. There are quick fixes. It is also a word to us to remember and recall that despite our own theological traditions and our own acuity, we may, because we are sinners, still not hear the question, still not understand what the other is saying, still not recognize that in our own clarity and sureness, we may also have some pride. And therefore, it is both to be self-critical and to be able to hear a society and say, "Yes, we know things don't turn out right the first time." I think the Lutheran Church would be a tremendous recovery group, a tremendous 12-step program for feel-good Christians who come into the Christian faith from others and assume that everything is going to be great once they have found Jesus. We are the ones who can tell them it is a long, hard road. We can reflect Paul's lament about what he willed and what he couldn't do. We have time-tested insights to offer people about the ups and downs of life. And our analysis of sin also then gives us another gift, and that is an understanding of baptism that is lifelong. You know, a lot of people baptize infants, a lot of other church traditions, but I know of no other church tradition which sees in baptism the symbol of the Christian life, daily dying and rising, daily being forgiven, and thus giving those who fall and fail the understanding that they can face those defeats, because there is a God who forgives and has promised steadfast love. To be baptized as an infant is a great symbol, a symbol of the priority of God's gift over our choosing, of the objective nature of our salvation, of the personal nature of God's coming and loving. These treasures need to be reaffirmed throughout the Christian's life. In so much of pop psychology today, it's an off-on, up-down, good-bad kind of trade-off. We understand in baptism that although we are transferred from a relationship of wrath to a relationship of love, that love is independent of our emotional state on any given day. Love so amazing, so divine, demands then our life and our all. And that leads me to a third insight which Lutherans have, and that is the understanding of Christian vocation. Lots of churches talk about the priesthood of all believers, and lots of them make that into a kind of excuse for independent understanding of Scripture, personal interpretation of the Bible. But for Lutherans, the priesthood of all believers is directly tied with a Christian vocation to be a Christ to the neighbor, both in terms of self-giving, but also, it seems to me, in terms of the first article of the Creed, also in terms of God's creative purpose for the world. We have a role to play. And to a world that sees itself marginalized, for people who believe that they don't count anymore, I think our understanding of Christian vocation says, yes, there is a place, there is a role for you. And this is particularly true to the young and to the old. To the young, because today's service is a tremendous motivator for young people. And I think we need, as a Lutheran church, to tap into every possibility we have to give young people the opportunity for volunteer or paid service opportunities. It is a way of saying, you matter, there is a place and a need for you. And at the other end of life, we have many Lutherans now who retire early because of health or because their position is such that they're permitted to, or they have to, because they are rift. They have resources, they have energy, they have a lifetime of skills. What are we doing to help them say, yes, you still have a vocation as a Christian. There are places and opportunities for you to serve. We've opened up many of these volunteer programs, but it seems to me there is a lot that can be done congregationally to think through what possibilities there are for the talented people that are in all our congregations. And the final thing, the final gift I think we have to share and offer as Lutherans is the understanding of the power of the Word of God. Now that can easily end up in a kind of automatic discussion about biblical authority. But I want to speak here rather in terms of the self-authenticating nature of the Word of God, the power of the gospel as Paul speaks about it. That is that we as a church need to help the world understand that the only real strength, the only real reliance and trust is in the God who speaks and who has spoken through the Son, Jesus Christ. For pastors, that's very important, because as clergy, it's easy for us to start looking at all kinds of outward accoutrements to bolster our, quote, authority, instead of recognizing that it is in the clarity of the word we preach. and the authenticity with which we preach it. But it also has to do to speak to a society that needs to hear that there is some truth in the world, that it is not all a matter of lifestyle or preference, but there is right and wrong, there is truth and falsehood. It's a very bracing kind of world to live in, but it's one that people have to be reintroduced to, because it's not the world they live in day by day. Now, it seems to me that this is a wonderful gift that God has given the church, this opportunity to share our tradition with a world that needs it. But it's also a daunting task, because there is so much need, and it seems so few to speak the word clearly. It is for that reason that we in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America have reached out to other Christian denominations, because we see our situation in the United States today very much a mission field situation. We don't think we can do it all alone, and we don't think that God has given all the keys of the kingdom to us. And for the same reason, we need to reach out to you. We need your help. We need it first to correct our own sinful ways, our own pride and self-deception that we have found the answers or that we know it all. We need to hear your witness, your experience, and we also need to work together, because I believe we share the traditions that I've mentioned, the insights, the Lutheran theological loci that I've briefly touched upon. And if we are going to face this crisis in our society, I believe that we need to do it together. Not only church to church, person to person, congregation to congregation, but of course also in the confidence that it is not our work or our task. We recall Paul's words to the Corinthians, "Such is the confidence that we have through Christ toward God, not that we are competent of ourselves to claim anything as coming from us. Our competence is from God, who has made us competent to be ministers of a new covenant, not of letter, but of the Spirit." 2 Corinthians 3, 4 through 6. In the confidence that it's God's mission, we can pray that our efforts can be used in that life-giving cause. And I hope we can do it together.
Bishop Anderson certainly has invited for us to set aside some time for any questions, either about his remarks directly, or I know from his sharing with the faculty yesterday afternoon, he would be happy to entertain other questions regarding the direction of his church and its relationship to ours as well. If you have a question, I would invite you to come to one of the microphones on the floor.
Bishop Anderson, you have given us a lot to think about and much with which we can agree, and of course some areas in which we might need to discuss your evaluation of society and things like that. By way of a sort of preface, I have a younger brother who is a pastor in the ELCA. My daughter-in-law's father is a pastor in the ELCA, and I served a congregation in the Richmond, Virginia area, and there's a considerable number of ELCA congregations there, and I enjoyed a lot of collegiality with the people in that area. But in view of the actions of the ELCA's General Assembly or National Assembly last summer, it seems to me one has to, and kind of in view of your comments about providing a center or centering people in the American culture or society, one would seem to have to ask whether the action of the ELCA, especially in sort of linking itself more closely with the Reform, whether that has actually sort of obscured the center, made the circle fuzzier instead of more distinct.
Yes, thank you. That's a very critical issue to face, and you give me the opportunity to say a bit about it. It's important for me to say at the outset that the ELCA, when it discusses matters ecumenically, does work out of an image, a mental image of a center and periphery. And in the case of the work with the Reformed, it was the judgment of the Church that the center, the commitment to the creeds, to the body of the Christian faith, including the understanding of the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper, was sufficient to say that we do represent a common heritage in this way, but that there are issues remaining which are different, and we do not, as Lutherans, acquiesce to the way, for example, the Reformed Church would understand the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, the how, but we were convinced that the what was in common. And therefore, we were enabled to say what remains different is not church dividing. It is different. We are not saying we have agreed in all matters, but that the differences are not church dividing. And let me just read the paragraph that is key to us in this. In the document, it quotes the Leuenberg Agreement in these words. In the Lord's Supper, the risen Jesus Christ imparts himself in his body and blood, given for all through his word of promise with bread and wine. He thus gives himself unreservedly to all who receive the bread and wine. Faith receives the Lord's Supper for salvation, unfaith for judgment. Now, on that basis, it seemed to us that the full presence of Christ, the relationship between the Christ and the earthly elements with the bread and wine, not our word in, with, and under, but with, and the so-called communication of the impious, that is, that the presence of Christ is there, whether or not faith creates the presence of Christ, separates this view from the Zwinglian view that I think most of us have considered to be, quote, the Reformed position. So it was on the basis of that kind of process, and we could obviously deal with others as well. God's will to save, the whole question of predestination, questions having to do with the church and the world. But I think to say this at this point, we believe that there was a common center and that as far out as it was necessary to go, we had agreement, but that there were further disagreements, and the formula says we need to keep talking about these. We can learn from you. You can learn from us. We do not necessarily believe that we are pure gold to the very end. There may be some need for us also to think about our positions in new ways. That's a start. Yes.
Bishop Anderson, thank you for your presentation. One of the issues that was addressed at the Philadelphia Assembly last summer was the issue of abortion.
Abortion. Yes.
3 years ago, after the issue had been publicized in places like the Lutheran Forum, that the ELCA has been funding abortions under its health plan since inception, a proposal was put forward by the Board of Pensions that would have restricted that funding to the so-called hard cases, and that was voted down by the Church Council. But this summer, a proposal was put forward that would have imposed those restrictions on late-term abortions, and that was overwhelmingly defeated at the Philadelphia Assembly. At the same time,
I think that's not correct. As far as I know, our church does oppose and has opposed late-term abortions. What was turned down at the Philadelphia Assembly was the same proposal that the Church Council had voted on earlier, put in another way. It's my understanding now that our church opposes unconditionally late-term abortions.
No, I'm saying that it was, there was a proposal that would have restricted the funding of abortions through the medical plan of the ELCA. It would have restricted them after 20 weeks. And that proposal was put forward, and that proposal was voted down.
Well, we have the statement okay.
And but ahead. Then the other part of the question, the formulative agreement puts the ELCA in alternate public fellowship with the Presbyterian Church USA and with the UCC, and a proposed agreement that's anticipated in the future would do the same with the Episcopal Church USA. Those are three of the four institutional members of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, which is probably the leading abortion rights advocacy organization, or one of them anyway. And they actually see the defense of abortion rights as part of their mission and ministry. I'm wondering, in view of that, what you regard as the future of the ELCA in relation to that issue.
I don't see the ELCA liberalizing its abortion position because of this action. I understand that from your point of view, the ELCA is not where you are. But from our point of view, abortion is wrong. And we say that quite clearly in our abortion statement. We do not believe abortion is the solution for unwanted pregnancies, but we leave the decision about that to the mother and in conjunction with a physician. In other words, we give guidance, but we do not condemn persons for making choices about which we may not know all the circumstances. So we have tried, on the one hand, to speak, to say that abortion is not appropriate and is wrong, but not to take it the final step in saying that in all cases we oppose a woman's right to make a responsible choice. The health plan situation is such that it was determined that for the woman to make that choice was important to maintain, and that if the health plan was altered, it would eliminate that part of our social statement. That is, that there is a moral responsibility placed in the individual, and that the individual's choice would be respected. So on that, for that reason, we did not slam the door, close the window totally. Now, I don't, the other church bodies have a lot of other positions, social positions, that we do not necessarily support or agree with. And I do not see much, I've not heard that whole issue of abortion raised as a pro issue for us. That is, well, let's get with these people because they will strengthen the pro-abortion view of our church. So I do not see that as having a strong effect.
Additional questions?
Do you see a difference between being a confessional church body and a confessing church body? And if so, what's that difference?
I could spin that out for a long time, but I don't know that it would be relevant. If you have a distinction, share it with me, and I'll say something to react
sure.
to it.
Confessional church body being that the emphasis is on the content of the confession, whereas a confessing church body, the emphasis is on what others, to make sure that others see that we are confessing, is placed above the other. Confessional
I guess
would be
you'd want to be both, wouldn't you? I mean, you'd want to be confessional, and then you'd want to make that clear.
Right, but does the ELCA, is there more of an emphasis on one over the other?
No, that's a distinction we haven't been, it's probably a very important and valid way of looking at things. I would say that we have not engaged in that vocabulary. We've generally assumed that we start with the confessions and then we try to live out the implications in our polity and so on. Sorry, it might not be satisfactory, but that's kind of where we are. Yes.
Thank you again for coming and speaking with us. At the beginning, you talked about us going down two different paths, ever more getting further apart. What do you see so that we can stand united and offer these gifts to a world that needs a hurting world? What, first of all, does the ELCA need to do to reach out to Missouri Synod, or what are they willing to do? And then what do you feel that we need to do as a Missouri Synod for our paths to start coming back together?
Well, thank you. I think that we need to try to communicate, to talk at all levels. I say at all levels because it's very easy in church bodies to assume that if you read something in one publication or another, you are reading the voice of the other church, and that's not always the case. And we are both rather complex church bodies. We have varieties of opinions, we have movements and wings, and the more we can check with one another, the better off we will be, it seems to me, in making sure that we are not, as President Johnson mentioned earlier, replicating stereotypes. So what I would recommend, and the fact that I'm here is an indication that the Missouri Synod is ready to do something about that widening gap. I have also said to President Barry in front of our convention that I apologize for anything that I might have done to widen that gap, because I think as a leader I have a responsibility to try to narrow the gap. So what I've been trying to do since is to say to our church at all levels, talk to the relevant group in the LCMS, whether it's congregation, synod to synod, synod to district, or whatever, institution to institution, movement to movement, learn more, find out more. And it seems to me that what you've done in inviting me here is a tremendous symbol. I have learned so much in this experience that I just wish more of our leaders would have a chance to do the same.
Would you mention again the four things that you thought were distinctive? I know the first was the simul justus et peccator, and the other three.
Second was baptism as lifelong, mm-hmm. rather than a once for lifelong. Third was Christian vocation, the understanding of the daily work of the Christian is also part of God's redemptive purpose. And finally, the authority of the Word.
I think we might agree that those are certainly important things, and I think ultimately derive what we would consider, I guess, the chief doctrine of justification is expressed in those four important aspects that you see the Lutheran Church bringing to the world. And I wondered if you would discuss the relation then, if indeed those are what is distinctive about the Lutheran Church, and if they're very important, and maybe aspects of the foundation of our faith, what then is the relationship of fellowship to church bodies that would not see those as important or see them not at all? It seems that there's the possibility then that those four things would sort of be not unique any longer or obscured then in trying to make a faithful witness in the culture as you described it.
My view, as I've understood other traditions, at least the ones we've been in dialogue with, is that, as you said, and I appreciate your centering us back on the chief article, I believe that that is shared by a large portion of the Protestant church in this country, and our recent discussions with the Roman Catholics has probed exactly whether Catholic understanding also can see the doctrine of justification as we understand it, and if they can see the critical nature of that doctrine for all of the church's life. So when I spoke of those four things, I was really speaking of Lutheran distinctives within the larger family of those who do confess the doctrine of justification as critical and central, but who perhaps do not draw these other conclusions as sharply and clearly as we do. So I think that's our gift to give to them. I do not think that means they would not accept them, but it means that they have not been the kind of choruses to the song that they have sung. They have had other ways, just as we could listen to them and hear how they, what special themes they raise out of their understanding of Christ's work for us. So I didn't mean to be either exclusive in saying those are the only four things, or to say that there other churches don't have them. But these are our special tonalities that I think are so critical. Let's go this side.
You've mentioned the importance of the Missouri Synod being involved in discussions as sort of a corrective body, and likewise the ELCA can have a positive influence on Missouri as well. I was wondering, what implications does that have then for Missouri's participation in interfaith and interdenominational dialogue, and does that mean that the ELCA is going to be more willing to include Missouri in such dialogues in the future?
Obviously, the inclusion or exclusion of any group is a joint decision on the part of all the dialogue members, or both the dialogue, or however many there are. The issue with Missouri, it seems to me, in the past, the reason that the ELCA has taken the present position is that our past experience has been that we have felt, and I simply want to express this as a feeling, it may be unjustified, that Missouri Synod representatives have taken part in discussions and have made demands or pushed discussions in certain directions and then refused to sign, so that the discussions have spent great deals of time dealing with material that ultimately was rejected by Missouri, and they became, the representatives became a kind of delaying factor rather than an effort to try to find common solutions. I say that's our opinion. I'm sure it may not look that way to the Missouri Synod, but I think that has been the dynamic, that we've gone down a road for a long way, and then at the end there's been a no, and we've been kind of left with a document that would not have been the same if the signatories themselves had been the persons who had tried to work to that point.
I think we have time for one more. There was someone at this microphone.
Actually, excuse me, Bishop Anderson, you touched on what my original question was with the article of justification, but I was wondering if you could flesh out for us some of the concerns going into the fellowship issues regarding the proper distinction of law and gospel. And I guess specifically in our own systematics textbooks, this is regarded as the central faith or proposition to the Christian mm-hmm. faith, that when people leave that proper distinction, they're spiraling outward of what Christianity is all about. Could you comment on some of the discussions regarding that?
That is an important inner structure for Lutherans. And we recognize it, and we live with it, and we check for it, I would say. It does become a part of the theological discussions. In the case of the relationship with the Reformed, we did not see it as their interpretation as that church dividing from us. We did not parse it the same way. And but we do, they also make distinction between law and gospel, but they do not follow exactly the Lutheran articulation or structuring. But we felt that there was enough agreement that we could live with the differences and continue to discuss them. I want to go back, and I hope I'm understood correctly here. Pure doctrine is a wonderful concept, a Platonic concept. In fact, however, human beings always, in my view, fall short of pure doctrine. And we struggle to find that. And it seems to me that one way we find it better is by dealing with others who see the truth differently, but whom we believe fundamentally approach the truth with the same faithfulness and effort that we do. And in that struggle, we may come closer to purity. But in the meantime, a little hybridization, a little alloy, may indeed be strengthening to the faith. A little paradox, a little struggle may indeed remind us that we are not yet God and do not have all questions fully answered. That may open up a bigger can of worms. But I simply want you to know that it's a part of, I've been a theologian, worked in theology all my life, and I have studied, I'm a historian by trade, and I realize that as I look back, one can see in formulations of the past that it hasn't always been God's own truth. It has sometimes been human pride and others that have blended in. So that's why it's important for Lutherans to dialogue with each other, to be accountable to one another, to be sure that we come as close as we can to understanding the mystery which we claim is the heart of God.
We need to draw the formal time for the convocation to close, although I know Bishop Anderson would be delighted to have conversation with you after the convocation prior to his next commitment. When I introduced Bishop Anderson, I described him as being forthright, honest in his views, articulate, and theologically astute, and we wish to thank you, Bishop Anderson, for validating that introduction. Thank you very much for your presence here. It's been a delight to have you on our campus.